Oh, good morning again. So, I think we didn't plan it like this, but Herman set me up nicely with the children's message, focusing in on the word glorify or glory. Because, and don't worry, I'm not going to do this, how would you respond if I said define glory? Or what does it mean to be glorified? Because those are not words that we use very often in everyday conversation, at least not in any way that's anywhere near how it's being used in John 17. For example, because we are also a school, I'm sure that there are days when our teachers, who work incredibly hard and do great work, in moments of frustration, might describe themselves as, quote, glorified babysitters. Now, I'm not saying that they are. I'm just saying sometimes it could feel like that. That's about the only time off the top of my head, we might use the word glory or some variation of it, and it's in a kind of a negative, sarcastic tone. Now, it does, in a sense, mean worship. It does mean like, you know, giving or ascribing something great to something or someone. But the way John uses it is a little bit more concrete. And unfortunately, or fortunately, when you read the book of John and you come across a big term like that, it is not enough to figure out what it means in that like paragraph. It's not even enough to figure out what it means throughout the whole book of John. You've got to look to the entire Bible. It's written very purposefully like that, both the book of John and the book of Revelation. They are like, and I guess Hebrews, they're like capstone books for the entire Hebrew Bible, because they pull all of these ideas and concepts that have very rich histories into a single moment. So, to see what I'm getting at, John, unlike Matthew and Luke, has no story of Jesus' birth, at least not directly. Now, Mark definitely doesn't. He just begins right when Jesus is a grown-up. But for John, rather than retelling the story of Jesus' birth, he instead gives us something vaguely resembling a hymn or a poem. And it really goes all the way back to Genesis 1, the first narrative of creation. And we're not going to dig into all the details, don't worry. But Genesis 1 begins with, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Or depending, there's a big debate. It could be when God began to create the heavens and the earth, whatever. And so John picks up on that and says, excuse me, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. Now, spoiler alert, the Word is Jesus. And not like the Word Jesus, but that is God's Word incarnate, uncreated, eternal with the Father. But also in some really weird way, Jesus as the person is the Word spoken to create the universe. Not meaning God shouted, Jesus, and it appeared, but rather Jesus is in some way the divine creating power and authority. As it turns out, the Jewish audience in the first century would just call that the wisdom of God. But as he goes through this poem and frames the coming of Jesus in the context of God's wisdom and God's creating power and God's presence itself, he comes to what I think anyway, is the most important verse in the Bible, John 1:14. And the Word became flesh, and he tabernacled. Like, it's a very sacred term. He tabernacled in a very sacred way in our midst, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only Son of the Father. In other words, as John has, has built up to this verse, and I know that because it kind of drops off right after that. He is weaving together God's creative divine power in the context of his word, but it's not his actual word, like, you know, I say chair or carpet or something like that. It's his, like, creative essence, in a sense, but it's also God's own presence, as well as God's wisdom. And all of that comes swirling together as a human. And the only way we can tell that is by beholding his glory. Now, that idea of, you know, beholding the glory of the Father then has a very rich use and a chain of meaning. We're not going to get through all of that. But suffice it to say that the glory of God for a Hebrew is his weighty, manifest presence that is basically, in almost every case, only experienced in the most sacred space in the cosmos, first in the tabernacle and then in the temple. And that glory, that weighty, manifested presence of God is frighteningly dangerous and immensely powerful. The best analogy that we have in the modern world is that it's like radiation. Radiation in its context is immensely powerful and can do incredible things. You also don't play around with it. At least you shouldn't. I know we did in like the 1920s and we learned our lesson badly. And so there's this constant tension then throughout the story of God and the story of God's people is this idea that God wants to be near his creation and involved in a very intimate way. But because of humanity's brokenness, we can't get too close without being incredibly careful or risking annihilation. And if you want to know more about that, check out the book of Leviticus. It is a gripping read. And the sad thing is, in the right sense, it is, but it's for detailed people. So you engineers and such, have at it. In any case, there's this constant tension between God's nearness and the danger of God's nearness. And that tension, it remains throughout the Hebrew Bible. And it's all swirling around, again, this idea of how is God going to return to his creation in a way that he can be close to his people without putting them at risk and in a way that is permanent. John, as he is in his opening salvo of his account of Jesus' life, and it's a very stylized, it's in a different order from all of the others because he's making some other points and we're not going to get into that. But John answers that question. God's creative, divine essence and power, which is also his wisdom and the very core of himself, becomes flesh, is a human being, and he walked around in and we got close to the sacred presence of God without getting obliterated. And as John's writing this, it's from the perspective of, like, I knew what his voice sounded like. I knew what it like to give him a hug. And it was Jesus. Now, fast forward to John 17. Because John 17, the whole chapter this time of year, we just each, over 3 years, we end up reading the whole thing. It's kind of a weird lectionary quirk. But this is all about, first, God's glory coming and Jesus glorifying the Father, which again is, as Herman said, an act of worship, an ascribing of value and appreciation, but it's more than just that. That's where it starts. But this is the moment of God's presence. returning to earth. This is the, to follow a bunch of analogies, the establishing the beachhead. The invasion has begun. God is finally acting and doing what he promised he would always do. And now we get to ride the wave of God's kingdom. And Jesus, throughout John 17, is pulling all of that together as he prays for not only his disciples, but for every disciple from that point on, meaning that Jesus actually prayed for you. And it all has to do with Jesus' desire that the glory of God, that he knows, will kind of reverberate into his followers, and that they will then become closer and they will know what God's presence is like. They will live in that glory. They will have the kind of connection to God that Jesus has with God, which I think we can all agree is a very tall order. And then, to finally get to my point, 11 minutes in, that's pretty good. He says at the end of this particular reading, my prayer is that just as, this is from Jesus' perspective, the Father and I are one, that they may be one. Y'all, us, people. In other words, one of the ways that God's tangible presence can be manifest, felt, experienced, is through unity. It's not, I think, a coincidence that Jesus prays for this while knowing this is one of the hardest things that we can do. And in fact, I don't know if you've noticed this, but us as human beings, not so good at the whole unity thing. Like at all. And this isn't just a matter for disciples of Jesus. This is a human issue. This is a current, modern issue as much as it was an ancient issue. It turns out people have been trying to kill each other from basically the beginning. I don't know, like day 9 or something. Something like that. And it doesn't take much to figure it out. Just turn on Fox News and MSNBC at the same time, I dare you, and try not to have a stroke. Because you realize it eventually, wow, they live in different worlds. I don't know what to do. But the reality is that we as human beings struggle to live together in any kind of unity. And the followers of Jesus are no exception. But there's also a sense of power in that. There was a, I guess this would have been like in the 90s. I know, so long ago, like back in the 1990s. There was a, and I never really watched it because I didn't care and hated this kind of show anyway. There was a show on MTV called The Real World, and it's kind of like where people stop acting and then they get real. It's kind of the ancestor of all of reality TV show, therefore it is anathema. But, that's a joke, but whatever. But the premise is interesting. What happens when people start getting real? And rather than just playing nice, their true selves come out. I think we can all agree that's when things do, in fact, get real. Real hard. Sometimes. However, that is also the moment when communities have a tendency to grow. When we have conflict, that does not necessarily mean that something has gone wrong. In fact, it means probably something has gone right. The problems come when conflict is handled poorly. Or for those of you who are married or have been married, you know, like that first argument during your first year of marriage over the dishes. And eventually you learn, oh, this isn't about the dishes at all. This is about how we communicate and what we're communicating and trying to work through that. And any couple who's experienced conflict will tell you that if that conflict is handled well, that relationship deepens. If it doesn't, that relationship becomes much more difficult. The same is true for larger groups of people. The same is true for communities like the city of Albuquerque, for larger communities like the state of New Mexico or the United States or the global community of human beings who are terrible at living in unity. And yet, Jesus has consistently said things like, his prayer for us is that we are one, even as Jesus and the Father are one. You don't get more one than that. He's also said that the world will know that we are his followers by the way we love each other. Not by how loud we are, how educated or smart we are, how organized we are, how, I don't know, entrepreneurial we are, how good our music is, how bad the preacher is, or whatever, but rather how we love each other. And as John brings Jesus' story to a close, he pulls all of these ideas together that one of the ways that we can experience the very presence of God is through each other. Again, tall order. But there, and I'll tell you, plainly, and I'm sure others who have been part of other church communities can tell you that congregations that have struggled and come out on top tend to be much stronger and healthier than those who have either handled conflict poorly or have never really had to deal with it. There is a depth, a weightiness there. A deeper sense of unity. Unity of at least, maybe not purpose, but at least a unity of intention. And that's worth its weight in gold. And you can start to see how Jesus actually, why Jesus and then John, as he's writing this, starts pulling together the presence of God and believers' unity. Now, if you want to test this or see it for yourselves, ask yourselves this: when has the community of God come through for you? Now, I fully understand that there are some of you that may not be true, at least not yet. My hope and prayer is that it does. And the reason why I ask it like that, as self-centered as that may sound, when has the community of Jesus stepped up and been there for you, is that it requires two things. God acting through his people, which is exactly what Jesus wants, and yours or my ability to be vulnerable. That second one's extremely scary. Being vulnerable is the worst. It's also the best thing for you. Because you, in your vulnerability, can admit need. Vulnerability, when properly worked through and expressed, can also develop a strength of character. It invites honesty about who you are. It invites growth as a person. And in the context of the people of Jesus and the way of Jesus that he set out, it is also an opportunity to learn to do the same for others. So when Jesus connects this huge story of God yearning to be present with his people in a way that was laid in the foundations of the cosmos, and that one of the ways that comes out is that we are unified as the body of Jesus himself, he actually means it. Now, I don't know about you, but sometimes people are like sandpaper. They just rub you the wrong way. and people with their competing backgrounds and ideas and views about how things ought to be done and different opinions about the way to do things and what's more helpful or less helpful and how to run things and all of that. People just have a tendency to irritate each other. What Jesus invites us to do is begin that conversation with the way, begin that conversation rather, or that process, by first admitting the way that I'm hard to live with. Not like just me, that'd be terrible, but the way everybody is. Because we can't have vulnerability without a sense of honesty. And that honesty and that vulnerability will feel like death. At least it can. It is no coincidence in any sense that John, as he is finishing composing this part or editing together or whatever, this part of Jesus' prayer, that Jesus then immediately goes and is betrayed. In fact, his betrayer is already at work while Jesus says these words. This is not a fancy high church prayer about our unity that without any skin in the game. It's from an ivory tower. It's meant to be flowery and sound nice. No, this is a gritty, real scenario involving real people with real human natures and all of the flaws that come with it. Jesus connects the very Chavod Adonai, the weighty manifest presence of God that has been in some way near since the foundations of the cosmos and is now visible and seen by the way that the followers of Jesus live together in unity while somebody is actively stabbing him in the back, knowing that it will result in his brutal public torture and death. It takes a lot to pray for the unity of the people when the people are actively trying to kill you. But I think that's exactly the point. I will end here. Jesus' call for us to live as a unified body of people requires us to be willing to be vulnerable, to be honest about the problems we bring to the table. And at the same time, there is truly something sacred about that moment because it is a moment of death. And as this story then plays out, that's exactly what happens. And in that death and in that moment when Jesus' body came alive again in ways that are very difficult to describe and understand, he seals that charge, that command for us, inviting us into that death. And wherever Jesus brings death, he brings new resurrection life. We as the church are charged to go and do the same. Not ignore conflict, not pretend like we don't have flaws or vulnerabilities, but rather in the death and resurrection of Jesus and taking part in that moment, to live in that vulnerability and honesty, to work through whatever differences we may have, and in that unity, literally change the world. The church has been doing so for 2,000 years. We can figure it out today. Amen. As you are able, please rise.